Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. England finished the summer with a record of 6 wins from 7 after a test at the Oval that will go down in the history books for a number of reasons. I'm Yaz Rana and today I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. There's a new issue out later this week. The managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. And for the last time, for the time being at least, Taha Hashim, who's leaving us at the end of this week.
So you've left the door open for him then, have you?
Yeah, I have. I mean, in the upcoming magazine, he's down as freelance writer and regular WCM contributor. So who knows?
For the last time, for the time being. What a phrase.
Unfinished business.
Yeah. For our YouTube audience, as you can see, our setting is a little bit different to usual, so I hope you enjoy that. We've got lots planned on today's show: the Oval Test, a continuation of Chris Silverwood's Sri Lanka revolution after they claimed the Asia Cup this week, England beating India in the first T20 up in Durham, Alex Hales's return to the England fold, the return of the county championship, and much, much more. But first, let's head to Mark Butcher to hear his thoughts on the final test between England and South Africa.
Mark, you've been at well over 100 test matches. What was it like being in the ground on that incredibly moving Saturday morning?
Yeah, that was something else. It really was. I don't think anybody really knew how to feel about it at the beginning of the day. Obviously, we'd had our instructions as to sort of the tone and the mood was meant to be somber and all that kind of stuff. So, absolutely, I don't think we needed instructions for that, but it was there and it was sort of hanging over the ground like a pall. But then when the team came down the stairs, I mean, the minute silence hadn't even begun by then. The team came down the stairs and the ground was absolutely silent. And you could hear like the studs clacking on the staircase as they made their way down. How Laura Wright sang the anthems in the way that she did, particularly ours, was something else. And, you know, Athers and I were first on commentary. We just sort of sat there. And that there are two counts. You get one count, we're on air, we're live, but then you've got another count going down in your ear for when the rest of the world will join. I'm presuming that quite a lot of people would have had the full coverage on anyway, but you kind of presume that they're going to start, that they'll be with you from 30 seconds to the first ball or whatever. And so we're sitting there and Athi's on lead and they start applauding, obviously, at the end of the anthems and the team getting their huddling, all the rest of it. And it just kept going. It kept going, and it's obviously the director's panning the cameras around, and I'm sitting there looking at Ath, and we're both sort of gulping, and he's going, no, not yet, not yet. So we waited. The count went all the way down to sort of welcoming all of the other broadcasters from the world, and still there was no need to say anything. You know, it was absolutely electric, and it's probably just as well because I don't think either of us could have got a word out at the time. It was really something. You couldn't help but think sort of, wow, imagine that up and down the country all day Saturday with all the other fixtures that didn't go ahead and all the other kind of stuff. But, people make the decisions that they make and they're all under different and varying pressures to do whatever they did. So, but I mean, cricket had it sort of spot, didn't it? You kind of had that Saturday all to itself, Saturday and Sunday all to itself. And the players, or at least England anyway, didn't disappoint. It was a fairly typical performance from them from start to finish. And what was, again, you know, I hate to say it, but it wasn't a great surface. We thought maybe that on sort of like the first day, with it having been undercover for all that time, yeah, fair enough, it was going to be a bit lively. It didn't really change very much by the time we got to the end, unfortunately. So,
what do you think was wrong with the surface?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, you know, you look at the county championship scores when Surrey had played at the Oval, there have been big runs made there. So I don't really know, in all honesty. I guess underneath the sort of the covering of grass, the actual sort of soil itself, it didn't seem to be very solid. And therefore, I think the ball just gripped all the way through the game. And it swung as well, because the ball wasn't going to get damaged. The outfield looks incredible at the moment. You know, I've not seen the ground look like that in September before. And so the ball stayed pretty much brand spanking new. And once the lacquer came off it and it started swinging as well as seeming, then good luck.
I mean, it's been an incredibly low-scoring series. The cricket was entertaining. The highlight reels were great. But it didn't really have the passage of play that makes a good series a good series, if that makes sense.
No, I think you're right. I think maybe there's one that sort of stands out. And I think that was that moment in the Test match at Old Trafford when South Africa had a chance and Folkes and Stokes slammed the door on it. I think that was kind of like, that was a high quality Test match cricket right there. You had, you know, Norkeer and Rabada and co. Reverse swinging the ball. Ben Stokes getting his nut down and repelling that, and then counter-attacking, and Ben Folkes playing. I think that was the sort of, in terms of quality, that was the highest quality cricket, I think, of the entire series, that passage of play. But the rest of it, you're right, it was, you know, two bowling attacks. I mean, bizarrely, South Africa they had the Fab Four for the first one that they won comprehensively, and then didn't play them together again, which I thought was extraordinary. I mean, you know, even given the issues with the batting lineup, you just thought, well, you know, a sort of a doubly bowling fourth seeming all rounder batting at seven is probably not going to score you that many more runs anyway. Why not play the four fast bowlers and hope that you can shoot England out for less than you get shot out for yourselves? But anyway, I mean, that's entirely up to them. But yeah, it was. Again, you know, there are always moments to pick out. You know, watching Rabada bowl at times, particularly at Lords and a couple of the spells at Old Trafford, was magnificent because he's just such a wonderful athlete. Jimmy Anderson was unbelievable once again, particularly, I think, on the flattest pitch of them all, which was the Old Trafford one. Ollie Pope played a couple of really, really, really top innings in very challenging conditions, one in this Test match and one at Lords. There were moments, but I think you'd be right, and I don't think anyone would think I was being churlish to say that the cricket overall was pretty low quality. It was high on thrills, but not very high on sort of substance, I suppose.
What did you make of yesterday evening? The umpires taking the players off with 30 odd to win.
Yeah, I think we kind of saw like. Maybe didn't see that coming, but we thought that perhaps they were a bit quick to take them off the night before. And of course, once that happens, that's where you're going. I mean, there's so many things about it that are wrong. Number one, why aren't we starting the Test matches at 10:30 in September? Because even when you add the time on, you know, so you add on the half hour, which is not even an add-on anymore. That's just part of the game. You get an extra half hour at the end of the day. That's a 6:30 finish. And then if you lose any time, you add it on at the end, which takes you to 7:00, and you're never playing at 7:00. Just not happening. So, you know, that in itself is something that really needs to be looked at. And then, like I said, once they'd made that call, that the umpires are given no room for common sense, I'm afraid. They are marked and they are governed by people above themselves. And the laws and the protocol say that this is what happens once you've got the reading from one day. It doesn't matter what happens on the next. You go off at the same time, no matter that there's only 30 runs needed to win the match and the series and save everybody the bother of coming back the next day and in front of the full house. They have no, their remit does not allow for that. So I have a certain amount of sympathy with them for it. However, they might have given us another 10, 15 minutes of play on the previous night, which would have meant that they didn't have that call to make. But it was a shame. And in fact, I was quite surprised, actually, that as many people came to the Oval as they did. I suppose if you've already decided that you were going to take the Monday off or whatever and come, then you might as well. And it was really nice to see the ground, not quite half full, but there was a decent amount of people there to see Ben and the team raise the trophy. And they, you know, I suppose if you look at it, if you just narrow it down to this last three test matches, you could sort of say, well, after all the build up, it was perhaps a little bit on the disappointing side, but that's only when you compare it to what had happened before. But then if you look back on the series and the test match summer as a whole, it's been incredible, hasn't it? I mean, there aren't many summers comparable with what England have done over the course of this time. There have been better series. Everyone can think of one off the top of their head. But in terms of the entertainment and the extraordinary turnaround of the team's fortunes, you'd be hard put to think of anything like what has happened in 2022.
Do you reckon they've got a chance playing that brand of cricket in Pakistan? The test matches that we've seen there since test cricket returned there have been slow burning affairs where quicks in your 40s don't have a huge amount of value in the grand scheme of things. Obviously, we don't know if pace bowlers will be fit then, but you know the way you win test matches in Pakistan in the last 3 years has been scoring big runs and actually quick bowlers taking wicket. Spinners have done really, really quite badly there.
Yeah, because it's been very difficult for them to get into the game. I think that's interesting because, I mean, the premise of trying to score quickly in Pakistan is quite a good one, isn't it? You're trying to add time to the game, I suppose. A lot of games run out of time there simply because the pitches don't deteriorate enough. So the faster you score, the more time, presumably, you get to try and take 20 wickets. The issue, I suppose, is that as you quite rightly point out, that means playing innings of substance. You've got to, not only have you got to score quickly, but you've got to score a lot because Pakistan's batting lineup is not South Africa's batting lineup. They will score a lot of runs at home. They're absolutely guaranteed. Rizwan, Baba, et cetera, et cetera. Those guys make big hundreds for fun. And so with the bat, put it this way. We're talking about the likes of, you know, some of the players who might have been who have struggled for form, struggled for runs. Somebody like Zach Crawley should really enjoy batting in Pakistan. He might have a lot of pace to work with in terms of, Nasim Shah and Shaheen Shah Afridi, etc. If they're all fit, you'll have a very small window of time where the ball does a bit of something when it's brand new, and then it's, you know, shin high bounce and hit through the line as much as you like. So that should suit him. Just fine if he gets through the opening salvos. But when it so the runs should take care of themselves. If England can find a way of kind of not giving wickets away, because I think that's something that when wickets are tumbling as quickly as they have done in England over the course, particularly over the course of this series, sort of throwing your wicket away or allowing teams back into it, knowing that you're going to be able to take 10 wickets pretty quickly yourselves is no big deal. Can't do that in Pakistan. That's signing your own death warrant over there. So got to be greedier. Not only you've got to score at a bit high tempos, but you've got to be greedier. And then with the bowling lineup, you've got to hope the ball reverse swings. You've got to hope that one of Wood or Stone or somebody is fit enough to go on the trip, because you have to have that pace. And then, you know, when it comes down to the sort of like the spin factor, Pakistan tend to eat ordinary spin bowlers for breakfast, don't they, as a batting lineup. So that in itself is a huge, huge challenge. Ben Stokes' knee is a huge challenge as well. I mean, how much work is he going to be able to do when the pitches get very flat and when the ball stops doing anything? So the 20 wickets thing is going to be much less straightforward in Pakistan.
And finally, you mentioned the fans that turned up today. If they stayed to the bitter end, they'd have seen and heard your interview with Ben Stokes at the end, where you put to him some of the criticism you've said on the podcast and on commentary. It was all right in the end. He took it pretty well.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. Yeah, and he came back exactly as I expected he would do. I mean, all the time during the and if people are listening for the first time, the criticism from me with him was not necessarily England's approach. You know, I think we're all kind of sold on wanting to watch that. It was a player of his quality, sort of getting out slogging. You know, that's been my problem. And so, you know, I put it to him that perhaps he might be selling himself short as a batsman. And he said, well, you know, we won 6 out of 7. I'll take that. I said, well, no, yeah, I get that. Absolutely. And all was well in the end. We're all friends. But, you know, I suppose throwing it forward, thinking back to that knee injury a little bit, and this wasn't the point I was making at the time, but it has occurred to me that at some point he might not be able to operate as an all-rounder, in which case England are going to need him to be and I think he's good enough to sort of average 50 for the back half of his career. You know, he averaged 40 over the course of this summer and he slogged it up in the air 6 times, you know. So just think how many, you know, and I think his team is going to need his runs, particularly when they play away from home, and particularly when they play against opposition who are not quite as acquiescent with the bat as South Africa have been.
Well, cheers, Butch. You're off to Pakistan soon, so no rest for you. Enjoy that, and we'll chat soon.
Speak to you from Karachi, probably.
So that first day was extraordinary. What was it like just being at the ground for start?
Yeah, incredible. Obviously, we'd had the day off before that, and then the day prior to that was just raining, but obviously everyone else was kind of following the news elsewhere. And then you get there for day three. And yeah, I was there for the silence, the anthems. And yeah, it was just very clear that you're part of a very historic moment. You've probably heard by now from so many people that it was quite a moving experience. Overall, my sort of impressions were, you know, it was a strange thing, really. Just, you know, trying to comprehend everything that happened in the previous 48 hours. And then it's like, let's get on with the test. And then the cricket itself was extraordinary too. You had Ollie Robinson bowl, you know, just an extraordinary new ball spell, just a crazy amount of wickets on one day. And it's very hard to just, even right now, to kind of process what happened on that day. It was, an odd day to be there.
Phil, this series was remarkably low scoring, two frail batting lineups colliding with two outstanding seam attacks, and the end result was a series that only saw two team totals of over 180. I thought it was entertaining, but also a bit hollow at times. It was on fast forward the entire time and didn't really have the ebbs and flows that we so love in Test cricket.
Yeah, and it will be forgettable, I think. I think this Test match that's just taken place will be unforgettable for obvious reasons, but the cricket itself lurched so quickly from inspired to inept. In terms of the reflection of both teams as well, you know, I mean, England were a bit of a disaster at Lord's. South Africa bowled very well, batted okay. They made one par score in the whole of the Test series, and that was at Lord's. And even that was only 270-odd, something like that. That was enough at Lord's, but this not even a soft underbelly with South Africa. I mean, a flabby, bloated underbelly of their batting was exposed, and we feared that might be the case. And we thought that England would have a little bit too much depth, and it really was kind of starkly evident at the Oval. I thought South Africa picked some odd teams. I was surprised that they hollowed out their middle order for the last Test match and put in one player on debut and one player who had never played a Test match in England and only played 2 or 3 games in Ryan Rickleton. And so I was surprised at that. It was always going to be one hell of a shot in the dark. I can understand why they felt that they needed to drop Markram, but then he's still a player that has some kind of experience of international cricket. I know he's going through a rough trot and so on. It felt like all the frailties of that South African side, that they were hanging in there basically from the time that they fell over on that first morning at Old Trafford when Elgar took a very daring decision to bat first, which is no longer in vogue in international Test cricket. And when it started to go wrong by lunchtime onwards, it was clear that the gulf between these two frail sides, sure, but with England's depth being so evident, I thought it was, it would have taken one hell of a performance out of nowhere, really, for South Africa to have got anything from that Oval Test match. And then I think, I don't think we can fully divorce what happened at the Oval from the extraordinary build-up to it. And the circumstances around that first morning, the intensity in the air, the sense of this being the first kind of collective outpouring, would undoubtedly have brought a different kind of energy to the place. That said, that doesn't result in bowlers landing it on a sixpence time after time. And Ollie Robinson's spell, I mean, if we're talking about out inspired moments through this peculiar series, then Ollie Robinson's new ball spell was his real graduation ceremony. I think that was given the new ball in the first place. I know, you know, he took the new ball earlier in the summer as well, but he's now the undisputed new ball bowler alongside Anderson in that side. And that was as good an opening spell as you can see. And I think the stats bear that out. I don't think, I can't remember what it is now, but I think only once before as an Oval Test match, first morning of an Oval Test match, delivered a new ball spell with four wickets in that first spell as good as that. So, you know, it's a sign of really a cricketer. I was going to say a cricketer reborn, but I think that's probably overdoing it a little bit, because he already came into this summer with a good record. But his attitude is clearly, the penny has dropped with him. He looks like a different figure physically. I think there's been some open and honest words regarding his own attitude, how serious he takes his privilege, if you like, you know. And I don't think this is just words that have dropped into his shell, like from a couple of coaches. I think he was aware of this as well. He gave a very interesting interview to Vidushan, the ESPN writer for the Wisden Almanac, where he acknowledged that he didn't knuckle down as he should have done in the first year of his career.
And this was before the John Lewis comments in junior.
Yeah, and Vish asked him about the John Lewis comments, and he's absolutely open about that, and he said it needed to be said. He didn't begrudge that. It came from the right kind of place. However, we've got to this point, we now have a fast bowler, or a medium fast bowler, who has added 2 mph to his repertoire, which is crucial. I think that difference between 80 and 82 at that level is crucial.
But also that speed's not dropping as dramatically,
and that's
across
the key,
spells,
yes,
as it was in Australia.
Exactly. So the median speed across the test match is maintained now. And that would have caused any top six trouble anywhere in the world at any point, as it was. He came up against a very frail one.
I mean, lots of English bowlers do well in home conditions, but, and I know we're talking about quite a frail batting line in South Africa, but Robinson did genuinely look like a world-class bowler, as Phil says, could take wickets. Anyway, we had a really good question, Robinson. Alex asks, did Ollie Robinson receive a hard time after the Ashes defeat, particularly the comments by John Lewis, throwing him under the bus when he did okay in Australia and was exceptional in the English 2021 summer, or was it necessary to unlock an even better bowler? I think that's a really good question.
Well, I think the thing I mentioned about Vish probably plays into that.
Yeah.
Lewis wouldn't have said that without having discussed it with the team management. You don't accidentally stumble into an interview as an assistant bowling coach and then, as the chap puts it, throw the bloke under the bus. So that would have been a clear strategy from the England management. And it was clearly something that Robinson needed to hear, and maybe needed to hear publicly, and maybe they needed to have that conversation out in the open. By hook or by crook, it's worked, because he's a different physical beast this summer to what he was last year.
And I think that raised eyebrows at the time, because you had England struggling, and you have the perception maybe of some people looking to pass blame onto others, and if there's a bowling coach and the bowling struggling, you're saying, oh, it's this bowling's not working hard enough, that can be something you think, okay, is this just someone trying to sort of varnish his reputation? But it's worth remembering that John Lewis and Ollie Robinson would have known each other really well. John Lewis would have spent time at Sussex, so that would mean that there would be quite a lot of trust there, which would allow you maybe to go in that bit harder if it needs to. It would also mean that he would know what kind of character Robinson is and what kind of motivational techniques are going to work. That's not going to be the right thing with every player. And I hope we are now getting to a stage where and in some cases we're not, where, you know, we realize that different players need some need an arm around the shoulder. Some you need to accept that if they're going to perform at their best, they're not going to have a body that corresponds with what we would traditionally associate with a top level athlete. And that can be fine tuned. Think about Lizelle Lee in South Africa, who's been forced to retire with concerns over weight, despite and them saying she's not fit enough, when she's their best player, essentially, or their best batter at least. And that's a different situation to this, is what I'm saying, is that this has worked, and therefore it was the right thing to do, I guess. And the reason why it worked is because they knew each other and there was that trust. And it, I have to say, it's a good, actually reflects well on John Lewis now, if anything.
Yeah, just briefly on Robinson, thinking back to the winter, against Australia, where there was that unedifying moment when he was bowling off breaks because he'd run out of puff and it was all a little bit ugly and embarrassing.
I thought he got too much stick for that.
However, right, okay, go on.
The criticism on the dropping in speed when he was still bowling seam was fair. I think there's one spell he opened at 67. But the off spin, I don't think the people around him should have let that happen. I think they should have been aware of the optics of this guy who's struggling with his fitness a little bit anyway, just resorting to off spin. It was the image of the day for those waking up back at home, having watched the ball of it. I think that wasn't just on him.
Yeah, good point. Very fair point.
Stokes has bowled off spin in a test before and we're not questioning his dedication and fitness, at least not in that point of view.
Yeah, so it just played into that narrative, didn't it? And that could have been avoided. But there are other motifs from that series as well, such as him nicking off Warner with deliveries that did have energy off the pitch. To be fair, those pitches in Australia, they did have a bit more than you'd come to expect. But this question regarding his propensity to do well overseas, well, we're going to find that out to begin with. But I think he'll go okay. And the reason why I think he'll go okay is not just this relentless accuracy and crucially the trajectory coming from that kind of height. But he bowls the natural length of a good bowler. And you're talking literally inches here. For a big fella, he naturally hits that length. And the bowler he reminds me of, and I'll get shot down for this, is McGrath. Now, McGrath was very straight lines. There was a kind of geometric quality to McGrath, if you like. And he had a brilliant wrist position. And with a tiny little deviation of the wrist, he could cut them in and he could hold a line. He didn't have a big away swinger, particularly, just as Robinson doesn't have a big away swinger. But he seams it and he just has that God-given innate knack for finding the right length. So you can be playing on a dead one in Rawalpindi, you can play to a green one in Dunedin. I think wherever he goes, I think he will, if he's fit enough, he will ask questions of you. And I think England have really found one there. And I think the questions regarding him as a cricketer last summer, I think you can be relatively confident that those questions have now been answered, I think.
I think they've also re-found one in Stuart Broad a little bit. He wasn't bowling badly at all to start this summer, but he was noticeably in those first four tests the weakest of those three seamers. There were already rumours, there had been reports that he was considering a time when he was dropped for the West Indies. Obviously, him and Anderson both come back in and England start winning again, which sort of managed to avoid that conversation somewhat. But I think when Robinson then returns and you've got Potts, who's been up to that point the find of the summer, and you know we have got Broad, who he loves his media work outside of it, and there were again murmurs that he was going to come to the end of the summer. We already know he might well miss the Pakistan tour because he's got a baby on the way. It all felt like it was maybe building towards this being the end, and he's been a bowler kind of almost transformed or reborn, I think, in that from that second test onwards, from when he had the new ball taken away from him. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant in both tests. He bought the ball to, I can't remember if it was two, but it was the one that he celebrated with Ben Folkes afterwards of the plan having come together, to Ryan Rickleton. That was a brilliant piece of bowling, a brilliant plan.
Absolute Jaffa.
And an excellently executed sort of a plan of attack as well. And Broad is also clearly now loving that environment that he's in. I mean, he obviously loves his role as the Nighthawk, seeing him on the balcony.
We've still not seen it yet.
Yeah, I know. And I hope we never will, in a way. Especially because, I mean, we could well have seen it today. He could have been a Dayhawk today, and they didn't do it, which perhaps suggests that it's something that they're almost thinking of as a...
You can't... So, look, I know that...
They call it that. This isn't an Andrew Millerism.
And I know the Twitterati will be saying, you know, get Anderson, get his pads on, get Broad out there, whatever. Sure, you can't take the piss.
Yeah.
But if you're South Africa and you've been over here for 2 months and then that is just simply taking the piss, you cannot do that.
There was an element of that today when Pope went for the root reverse scoop and Jansen was furious.
Right. Yeah, and you would be.
And McCullum after play said the only thing he's been angry about all summer was that Pope didn't try again the next ball.
So, yeah, there you go.
Just thinking out loud, can we be that critical of South Africa whilst also being giving the England bowlers that much credit. That makes sense. Like this, the pitches were reasonably helpful for seamers. Basically, everyone took wickets, and that is one of the weakest top six and sevens I can remember touring England in at least quite a long time.
Well, I mean, you can be critical from the point of view in that they didn't have what it took to negotiate the challenge on this tour. I don't think it's a question of, you know, of dedication or discipline or of them not wanting it enough, but I do think they have been beaten by a better team. But you're right, I mean, it's a hugely experienced team. I think Dean Elgar was the only member of the side in the last test to have 1,000 test runs to his name, which is kind of extraordinary in a way when you think about some of South Africa's batting riches in the past. And they also, I mean, yeah, so I mean, it's a weak batting lineup, and these were very, very helpful conditions for seam bowling. It kind of had all the ingredients for a historically poor series with the bat, which is what this was.
But also, we're talking about Broad and Robinson. With Robinson, it's not just about these last two test matches. If you look at his career record now, it's ridiculous. Well, 51 wickets at less than 20. So there's that.
Is it only Botham got there quicker for English bowlers? Is that right?
No,
it's quite a few. Since Botham, he's the quickest. So he's the quickest since Botham, okay. 50 wickets.
Joint with Cork, no?
Yes, yeah.
Blimey.
And then with Broad, I mean, England did lose that first test, and he wasn't great at Lords. I mean, yeah, he was kind of a bit too short at times, just a bit off it, really. That's why Stokes had to come in and bowl in that test, and kind of he was the one who kind of dragged him sort of back into it, even when they kind of did eventually fall to an innings defeat. And that's when he gets shunted down to bowl first change, and that's kind of the test, right? Old Trafford, how is he going to react? And he reacted brilliantly. So you do have to still kind of give both of those bowlers credit in that regard, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You thought Ollie Pope had a really good series.
I did. And I know he got the century against New Zealand, but I still, you know, there's still... I still wasn't convinced in a way, but watching him in this series, there's still that... So the criticism surrounding him over the last couple of years is he's kind of this almost fidgety presence at the crease and kind of, you know, like he can't rest. He's like always kind of moving about a bit. And that's not necessarily what you maybe look at for a number three. But he's just been in this series. He's just been, he had that in this test as well, where he was kind of like going down the wicket in his innings. And, but it was coming off. He was playing all the shots. Part of it was because he's at the Oval and he knows that ground so well.
He
and
did
so
it at Lawso as well, didn't he?
He did.
But he played an unusual innings for a number three.
Yeah. It's the innings you'd look at where that's the kind of innings you wanted to see Ollie Pope play at number six, but he's now doing it at number three, but it's working. And the fact is that at Lords, he was taking on Norkia, who was bowling 90 miles an hour and looking comfortable. And then I look at him in this test as well, and he was playing the short ball so well in this test. Like even this morning, he, you know, I think he got off the mark potentially with a pull shot. It just looks so good, so comfortable. And so he's moving around a lot, and the kind of stuff that was kind of, you know, his downfall of a year ago, he's made it a part of his game, and he just looks, he's looking, I mean, he's still not, you know, he's still averaged less than 40 this summer across the seven tests, and you wouldn't say he's had a worldie of a summer essentially, but he just looks quite obviously a lot more confident. He has obviously got that kind of that backing, and England have said, you're the number three, you're our man for the job. And for the first time, I think you're kind of looking at Ollie Pope, and you can kind of see what everyone was talking about at the start and what everyone was kind of hoping he would kind of become. And he's still, I mean, there's still a long way to go. Pakistan is going to be a very different challenge, and a challenge, you know, there will be a bit of spin, and that's something, you know, he's traveled poorly in his last two winters, essentially, right? You know, he really struggled in Australia. He really struggled in India. And so this will be that next challenge for him. But in terms of a body of work across the summer, this is obviously his best one so far in England.
There's been a slight technical change as well. We spoke about this before, but Alistair Cook noticed it over the winter that he had this slightly mixed technique, in as much as his bottom half was open and his top half was closed. The shoulders were pointing square side on to the bowler, but his bottom half was a bit more open, and so you'd get a slightly skewed balance. He's more side on now. And you can see that. And those shots he plays through mid-on, mid-wicket, he's standing relatively tall to those shots. It also enables him to play a little bit better as well. When the ball is in at the body, he can kind of manoeuvre himself around that. That's why, as you say, he's playing the short ball nicely. I like the impishness and the slight weirdness to it. I like the fact that he's prepared in his head to take a couple of steps down to a new ball. I like the idea. I like the mindset that he's now in, which obviously flows from a degree of confidence and believing that you're worth your place and you're justified to be there, which wouldn't have been the case for a year or so. I like the fact that he's prepared to walk at a left arm seamer who's 6'8". And it's counterintuitive, sure. And it's not something that we've ever seen from a number three. And yet there is logic to it, because if you sit in on these pitches against a brilliant new ball attack, then you will end up nicking one. His defence is not absolutely rock solid. He's not a Jonathan Trott-like player. He's more of a number five by nature. So he's trying to bring the impishness of having grown up against the white ball as well as the red, and batting at six, five and four for Surrey. He's moved slowly up there. He's now in this rarefied position, but he's still taking some of that imagination and creativity. And I think that's probably his best bet. If he tries to play in a conventional number three fashion, then he's going to dab at one, you know. And so to be proactive like that, I think, is the way to go. It's not going to come off all the time, for sure. But there is a rhythm to his play now, which you haven't really seen in a number three for England for a long, long time.
And I think Butch mentioned something about his off-stump guard, something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And you talk about that shot that he tries to reverse scoop Jansen or something. You know, he's not playing that a few months ago. And it's just, I guess it's a sign of kind of where he is at with his game, where, you know, he is quite comfortable now, and he's like, he feels at home in that position, I guess, where he can kind of, I know that, you know, the game's basically done, but, you know, he feels that, I guess, in that environment, he can play that way, and that's fine.
Phil, in the fourth innings, Crawley and Lees put on their second 100-run opening stand of the summer. The other one also came in a successful fourth innings chase.
In the India game.
Yeah. Mm. Do you see them both going to Pakistan? I thought it was a very similar fourth innings to the final test of the 2017 summer England West Indies, where you had Mark Stoneman and Tom Westley, two guys who you weren't sure if they were going to make the play, knocking off 100 in the final test of the summer.
Where do you say that?
Stoneman goes to Australia, Westley, 44 not out, never plays for England again. Yeah. What do you think will happen to Lees and Crawley? It's been a very strange summer. There was a stat that we were talking about before we were recording that Matt Roller put out on Twitter, that Crawley averaged 23 opening and batting this summer, which is pretty much identical to all the other openers combined.
Yeah. And within that collection of players, there's some good players there. Yeah. And as he says quite rightly, Matt Roller, star of the show from last week, by the way, I thought he was great. Conclusion, it's no picnic opening the batting in England in Test cricket. Straight answer to your question, I think Crawley definitely goes and definitely starts in Pakistan. I'll come to that in a minute. I think Lees, there's more of a question mark against him. They are loyal, of course. They will like the fact that Lees has tried to expand his natural game. But in the end, they will take a view that there may be other options out there that they might want to look at. You know, Lees averages 25, 26 from 10 test matches.
Less than that, it's 23.
Let 23 from 10 test matches. He offers something different to Crawley, although the numbers are kind of remarkably similar, but he offers something different to Crawley that I think Crawley will benefit from in the short term. And as I said on this show before, I think there's more longevity in Crawley as a test player than I think Alex Lees. He's hinted at having the right stuff, but not enough to convince me. And the question will be, how much does loyalty and good club ability, if you like, how much is that offset by the fact that he has a high score of 67 across his career so far? Should have been out first ball in this chase, could have been out soon after as well. He was put down twice. Pretty easy chance, really, that slip catch that Jansen put down to the very first ball. There are other options, you know, for sure. Keaton Jennings is an interesting option, but there'll be others as well. Ben Duckett, we mentioned it before the show began. They've looked at him. He came into the squad. He's a versatile player who can go up top. Obviously, left-hander, he can go up top. He can bat three, he can bat five. So more of a question mark against Leeds, I think. But you know, we shall see. Crawley, look, I don't take my badge on this, and if you're watching or listening out there in the Twitter sphere, don't shoot me down. But my moment of the week, on a cricketing level, obviously, was that first 10 minutes of his innings in that chase. And he played 3 shots. And I know this is a hackneyed old point, right? Because if you watch Crawley in isolation, you can understand why they like him. But they are so pure and so persuasive when you watch him on a good day or in a good minute, that this is why they keep coming back to him. He played one off drive, flowed into the shot beautifully. The next over against Rabada, slightly short of a length outside off stump. No, not much more than that. He's gone right on the top of the bounce and punched it. And it's crunched through the covers. And then next over, there's an on drive, again, right out the screws. 3 brilliant shots, 3 different areas of the ground, and against high pace. And this is why he should go to Pakistan, and why I would want him to go to Pakistan, because what he'll find out there is some flat tracks if you get in, but some extreme pace as well. That's what he'll come up against. And all the data tells you that while he doesn't score enough runs, his quality against uber quicks is of a very, very high ceiling. And he can hit good balls for 4 because of his height, because of his natural timing. He's going to get a lot of good balls. He's going to get a lot of pace on the ball out in Pakistan. And you can absolutely understand why they want that kind of player. Even if he only comes off one innings in 6, you can understand why they want that kind of player. I've always understood it. I've known that throughout this conversation, the Zach Crawley culture war, I know that I don't have much of a leg to stand statistically. I know that 160-odd not out doesn't begin to cement a place. But I understand the rationale. I always have understood the rationale. They extend it beyond reasonable bounds. Sure. If they dropped him for this series, I wouldn't have had any complaints. But I can absolutely understand why they continue to go back to him. And what you saw in that India chase is more telling than what you saw yesterday, I think, because that India chase, he was excellent. I think he got 48, maybe. I think it's one of 340s he's got this year. And, you know, another day, he's got 450s this year, you know, just with a little bit more on those 3 innings. But what he offered them, that little snapshot, that's why they keep going back to him, because there's no one else who plays quite in that particular way.
I guess what's kind of also remarkable about the innings that he's just played is that there was almost this, as the series was going on, as the summer was going on, you had this kind of divergence between what England was saying about what Crawley is as a player, is that, oh, you know, he's a match winner, you know, he'll, you know, he can play shots that no other guys can play, and you get that. But as they kept on saying that, Crawley himself was trying to give himself a chance of being more consistent. He was being a lot more patient at the start. He was trying to leave the ball more. He was kind of reining in his shots. And so what happened yesterday, kind of, in a way, kind of came out of nowhere, but also the situation was built for, okay, no, we want to, you know, Stokes said himself today that they wanted to knock the runs off last night. And so Crawley kind of had to come out and play like that.
It's weird to say, but that 38 he made at Old Trafford, when he was, what, 17 not out off 80-odd balls at the close of play, that could be a career maker for him, because he came in with all of that noise around him, as you say, Taha, and he played the circumstances perfectly. And he kind of got a bit lucky the following morning and inched up to 38 and nicked off. But in the context of that game, that was an important innings. And that, I think, will be the benchmark for him. And if you can find a bit of light and shade, if you can find a bit of versatility as a player, if he can tighten up by 7-8% technically, a bit more, he needs a bit more liveliness with his forward block for me. He hangs the bat there a little bit, so you're asking for it with a little bit of movement. If you sniff it out that little bit more, play it slightly later, he doesn't need to improve that much more, I don't think. For him to start to look like a player. But, you know, I sound like a broken record and probably
no,
wrong.
I completely see what you're saying.
Pakistan is fascinating for him. Just, I know I'm ranting a bit, but Pakistan is fascinating for him because you're not going to get a massive amount of lateral movement unless the ball goes old. And if the ball goes old, he's already in. But the 100 that you saw him make, no, you didn't actually, but you went to West Indies U2 and but just after he'd made that 100, made his 100 on a flattish sort of track against a decent pace attack at Antigua. Was it Antigua?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. He's going to get a bit of that, or quite a lot of that in Pakistan, I think. And if he bums out across three test matches in Pakistan, then I sound even wronger. But I continue to believe that there is a player in there. Mm. And I think they are six very, very important innings in his test match career, because he will find conditions that should be conducive to his kind of play.
One, I think the Antigua 100 was the one that made me think he's got a shot of being a consistent test opener the most, because it was a normal test innings. But as you said, we've seen two extremes almost in the Old Trafford 38 and the 70 not out at the Oval. And I guess one thing that England, the way in which England have praised Lees and Crawley this summer, is kind of comparing their returns to the expectations of what it's like to be an opener and their contributions in wins where they've got England off to a couple of good starts. You were there in Pakistan earlier in the year. Test in Pakistan is very, very different to what we've seen in England this summer. Abdullah Shafiq's just scored hundreds and hundreds of runs. Imam scored loads and loads of runs. Mm. That's what it takes to win Test in Pakistan.
You can't call a 38 a good score in Pakistan.
Exactly.
But equally, and it wouldn't be.
I would say that it's tricky. I mean, Crawley has struggled both technically and temperamentally, I guess. But there has been a big technical question there. And when he's got those runs, all his hundreds have come on flat pitches, basically, which, you know, you can use to as a stick to beat him with when he comes back to England and struggles. But equally, he is probably going to get some flat pitches over there. And he has shown that when he does come to those sorts of conditions, he can make, well, he can make absolutely massive scores, and he can make big scores as well. And I said 300s there, including the 77 in Australia's three highest scores that will come in those sorts of conditions. Mm. So yeah, it really is make or break for him. But it would also be absolutely bizarre for him to stick with him for this long, for him to just look like he's trying to crack it and then to go another way now. So I think we've definitely got at least three more tests of Zach Crawley.
Yeah. I think I can already
hear...
He's
great to watch, by the way.
Yeah.
That on a level, yeah. I know I sound like a schoolboy, but he is great to watch.
Yeah.
He also did all right in his last innings against Pakistan.
Yeah.
He did do okay.
He did do okay there. I can hear the Twitter replies already. I think there are a lot of...
Yeah, just cut all of that.
One thing I was going to say is I think there'll be a lot of county players out there thinking, if I had this many chances, I would do better than this.
And there is, it is worth putting forward that there is another logic here that England, you know, think that if we pick this guy and he comes off one in, I mean, six is even, that's quite interesting with how he's gone, like one in 10 times, he might win us some games. The other way of looking at it is that if you do pick the guy who's going to get through the new ball the most often, we've seen how hard facing that new ball is. This is quite an old school way of thinking. It's a very McCullum Stokes way of thinking. But if you do, you know, get through that first hour, that is going to make it so much easier for your other match winners in the middle order to succeed and to not be 55-6. I mean, England have won 6 out of 7, so, you know, that has worked, but it is still possible to think that the other way might be more consistent overall in the long run. And
you know, you're not going to see it, though, I don't think. And in Pakistan,
yeah,
test
no,
ma-
not,
test
not, not
matches
in Pakistan,
go
it's very
go
different
the duration,
true,
don't they?
Yeah.
You know, and we saw that with the Australia series. You know, Pakistan saved one of them when they batted for 4.5-5 sessions. And so a player like Crawley is absolutely what they're looking for. Whether he is a simulation of the right player or not, well, time will tell.
And I think we'll see England going further that direction.
Yeah.
I think...
Ben Duckett is an interesting option.
So we're going to come to it later, but there was a really interesting segment on Sky today before the fifth day where Mo Boba and David Court, who are both part of England's player identification system, both lead it really, they were interviewed, and Joe put it quite well in our WhatsApp group. It was surprisingly transparent. And one of the things they put on was their depth chart, which is they put on the screen eight openers who they're keeping a close eye on at the moment. Six number threes, 10 middle order batters. It's quite interesting that Duckett was in all three categories. They view him as a very versatile player. And if they do view him as an opener, which I don't think was something that was guaranteed given he batted in the middle order against South Africa when he played for the Lions, I do think if they're viewing him like that already, he fits in the way they're trying to play.
Yeah. Just that point that Joe made about the transparency. Well, Mo Bobat was this kind of mysterious, enigmatic figure in English cricket. And part of the reason was that they didn't, the ECB, the oldish regime, if you like, they didn't want him doing too much media because they felt like he liked the cameras a little bit too much. And I've heard this from ECB employees. And they wanted his role to be sidelines, really, which again is slightly odd, but it reflects a more open and progressive approach, I think, that you're seeing flowing from the pitch to the way that they're going to go about their business from here on in. And it's obviously a positive thing. It was a fascinating interview, as you say. You're going to come to it a bit later, but it's a good sign, I think.
Finally, on the English test team at the moment, Billy asks, what represents a good winter for England? Not just results wise. Personally, I would say winning a test in Pakistan would be amazing, but in terms of how they grow as a side and through individual performances. England play three tests in Pakistan at the end of this year, then two tests in New Zealand at the start of next. Ben, do you want to go?
Yeah, it's hard not to view it in terms of results because of how good the summer's been. I think they should be aiming quite high, and I think they will be. I think they should be looking at that Pakistan tour as a chance to get quite a landmark win. I mean, that Pakistan side is an odd one. I mean, they have some brilliant pace bowlers, got some brilliant batters. It will not be easy at all. But equally, they've been turned over by an Australia side that England should be looking to compete with at some point. And, you know, they drew a test series in Sri Lanka. We'll come to that later in the show. But so I kind of think they should be looking to win that, really. And I think it will be a bit of a disappointment if they do lose it and if the batting frailties return. I mean, considering how England's approach should be built for the kind of flat pitch you're going to see there, that should be a real opportunity for them to do something quite special. The New Zealand tour,
if they win in Pakistan, it'd be an amazing achievement, I think. If they win two test matches in Pakistan.
Yeah, or win one and draw two, possibly. I know they don't draw
games
anymore.
Draws look very long way away,
don't they? But the conditions there have been so flat. And it's worth also, I don't think people have quite quantified how hard it is for spinners out there. People think it's going to be there. You're going to like it was last winter when England were, two winters ago and they were turned over by Akshar Patel, etc. Since Test cricket returned to Pakistan, spinners have averaged basically 50 in the country. It's the hardest place to bowl spin in the world.
You were there. How do you see it?
Well, the thing is, I feel like once the build-up starts to that series, a lot of focus is going to be on Jack Leach and how Jack Leach goes. But people need to understand that the main concern for England right now is that they need pace. They need a bit more pace to compete in Pakistan with those pitches. This attack here that's been excellent that we've just bigged up, that doesn't work in Pakistan. And now, so they've got Mark Wood, who's coming back for the World Cup, who was actually bowling at the Oval during one of the warm-ups.
Ollie Stone's back in that T20
Ollie Stone, squad. Yeah. But then the question always is with the extreme quicks is that they're always going to be more prone to injuries. And so can you get at least a couple of those guys into the squad fit for that series and ready to go and at least have one that's playing and, you know...
Guess Jamie Overton comes back into it as well.
Yeah, but Jamie Overton, we saw as well, He did well on his test here. He bowled all right, but he's still not in that bracket of the top three of Wood, Stone,
Jamie Overton
and Archer. And so that's the key question for them. And if they can't get those express quicks, like the issue they basically had in Australia as well, they had Wood, but then they didn't have anyone else supporting him. How do you adapt? How do you go about it? Do you basically use Anderson as your kind of almost like a spinner where he's holding up an end, but then who comes and attacks from the other end? It's the attacking options that they lack. Defensively, if you're not looking at Leach as a defensive option, and especially this summer, he's been an attacking option, flights up, gets the fielders up, and he's attacking. You will have to adapt to Pakistan and be a bit more defensive at times. And so you'll have to look at, you know, Anderson, Robinson, those guys can be the defensive options. Who's going to attack for England? Leach will have to do it. But you can't just rely on the one spinner because spin has been tough in Pakistan. To bowl spin has been really tough. And those Pakistan players play spin brilliantly as well. And so it's the quicks that come into the equation. Reverse swing is key. I don't know what the fitness situation is with Saqib Mahmood. He's been talked about, a guy who can...
Forgot about him, it. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with, you know, so many injuries that England have at the moment.
This is the stuff we're going to lose. I hope the listeners really appreciate that beautiful monologue, because they're going to be few and far between from here on in.
He's going to remind us about the existence of Saqib Mahmood from now on.
The other quick one, as we're talking about it, idly, Moeen Ali is up for it. He's put his hat in the ring. Obviously, he's taking the T20 side to Pakistan, which is great in itself. But he's interested, if required, to play in that setup for the three Test matches. Could be an interesting option there at 7 or 8. You never know.
Well, he could slot into the top six, really, in those conditions as well. free up a bit more space bowling wise. But then who also who out, comes
yeah.
from?
Yeah, who you're leaving out, and I wonder if Moeen's looked at the actual numbers of
potentially Brook.
Yeah,
if Beto's injured.
Yeah, definitely. The other big news in relation to England this week was that Alex Hales has been added to the England squad for the T20 World Cup after Johnny Bairstow was ruled out of that tournament. It's Hales' first England call-up in over 3 years since he was initially banned for failing a drugs test on the eve of the 2019 World Cup. Ben, did you see that coming?
It felt like a possibility, but I was still a bit surprised. I mean, only because England have often played lip service to the fact that Alex Hales is available selection, but they're going other ways, and this felt like it could well have been one of those. From a cricketing point of view, though, I mean, I think there's been some people who have been unhappy with his recall for other reasons, which we'll get on to, suggesting that he doesn't really have a cricketing case over the likes of Will Jacks, which I don't think is true. I think Hales, there's a few things to point out. One is that I think he's actually a better T20 batter, at least, than he was when he was with England. And that he's actually, he's up, his numbers are up there with the very, very best in the world. So I did a bit of looking into this since the start of 2020. This might well have changed when I looked into this. Rizwan's got another 50, so he might have just edged above him. But when I looked last week, since the start of 2020, he had scored more runs in T20 cricket than anyone else in the world. He was also, if you bring the cut down to 1,000 runs, quite a lot of people have got that many. But the only person to average more and score quicker was South Africa's Riley Rousseau. So I guess the two caveats is that Hales hasn't played in the IPL and the international cricket, but he has gone and done really, really well in the Big Bash. Done really well in the PSL. He's had a really good summer. Even though he's not going to be, your David Milan or your Joss Butler, who's averaging sort of 50 in the format, but he does get you off to ridiculously fast starts. And the T20 Blast, he was striking at over 190, which is absurd. And Ben Jones from CricViz did a piece on this at some point last year about the change he's made to do this and what he's really excelled at now. He's just changed how he plays against left arm spin, which used to be a bit of an Achilles heel. Now he's able to sort of open up, hit it over the offside in a way that he couldn't before, and that's made him kind of the complete T20 opener, really, who has completely no fear. But I think we should talk about the other stuff, and it's not the team environment stuff is something for, you know, it's impossible for me to tell about that. The stuff about him having, you know, done some recreational drugs in his time doesn't really bother me. The thing that is a bit sort of that has been a bit buried almost, and it was a story I think in the Daily Mail this week about the fact that he's not been charged over his involvement in the Azeem Rafiq racism scandal. So clearly the ECB have satisfied themselves with that, but I think the general public may well not be satisfied. I mean, that was one of the most shocking allegations really from Azeem Rafiq's testimony, was that there was a racist nickname he alleged that was there was common knowledge in the England dressing room, and that Alex Hales was a key participant in that. Obviously Hales denies this, and the ECB have chosen not to charge him, so they have clearly satisfied themselves as well. But there's been no public airing of that. We don't know what the reasons are for that not decision. We don't know really what the truth not of it is. It's been kind of just one of those things that was said and is kind of just sitting there, and I can see why England fans would be concerned about that. I mean, I'm a bit concerned about it, so that's my view on the Hales thing, I guess. But to answer your question, from a cricket point of view, not surprised. And Rob Key did almost, not that he would feel backed into a corner, but he spoke very glowingly of Hales in the press conference before Bairstow got injured, saying that that he was really close, but that we wanted to go with them, and that, you know, the other stuff was just in the past, and that the guys who were picked in that Pakistan tour were partly there for the experience, because he was the future. All of that kind of left that door open for Hales. And I guess they've gone with the point of view that he is the best guy to win them the T20 World Cup, which I guess from a cricket point of view purely is the case.
The circumstances, everything has kind of worked out in his favour in terms of you've got Roy out of form, Bairstow injured. But beyond those two, if you look at the kind of next two names on the list, essentially would be Phil Sort and Will Jacks. Will Jacks still hasn't played in international, so we don't really know much about him at that level. And then Phil Sort has played four T20s, but he's not actually opened for England yet in international cricket. He's obviously done the job in franchise cricket and done really well. So there's still an unknown there. And so for a side that has actually had quite a difficult time recently, they've struggled really, this England T20 side, ever since that World Cup. They've gone for the kind of cold, hard, sort of ruthless option. And you mentioned there how well he's done in terms of franchise cricket. I'm not sure that's the kind of clincher there in terms of why England have picked him. I think it's basically because of the international pedigree that he has. You could have looked at James Vince, and he's got an excellent recent record in the BBL, done really well there for Sydney Sixers. But it's what Hales has already done in international cricket. And the reason his international career is, you know, he's lost his place a couple of times, is one in the aftermath of the Bristol incident, when, you know, Roy and Besser came in and, you know, you couldn't drop either one of those. And then one with the what happened in 2019. So it's not about, it's never been really about the player and what he can do. That it's just, it's a guarantee that he can kind of nail it at this level. It's one of those calls that England have made where it's like, well, we're here to win a World Cup, and any way to do it, that's what we're going to do.
I mean, so
that's
point
they brought him back.
The point that everyone made before they criticised JC Roy this summer was that he's a England white ball great and he's achieved so much. Hales and Roy were neck and neck. They basically came to the side at similar time. Hales slightly before Roy, but their records were very, very similar. And arguably, Hales was a better T20 batter throughout. Roy perhaps had the edge in ODIs, but in T20, I think Hales probably had the edge throughout. Moving on, one of the stories of the week for the international game, perhaps the story of the week actually, Ben, is Sri Lanka winning the Asia Cup. There's quite a lot that happened in the last week in the Asia Cup. Virat Kohli finally scored his 71st international 100 that three-year wait came to an end. There was an amazing game between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Sri Lanka, who haven't even qualified directly to the main bit of the T20 World Cup this year, ended up as champions.
Yeah, I mean, it was a brilliant tournament and a brilliant last week, especially. You had sort of tactical intrigue, you had competing philosophies, you had real passion, you had sort of personal narratives going on. We'll come to Sri Lanka, but my moment of the week, and one of the best games of T20 cricket I think I've ever seen, really, was the Pakistan-Afghanistan game. Sri Lanka had beaten India the previous night, which meant that a win for Pakistan would mean it would be a Pakistan-Sri Lanka final. But going into it, all teams were still in contention. It was a low-scoring thriller. Pakistan took it deep, as they like to, but Afghanistan bowled really, really well. So Pakistan need 39 from the last four overs, 6 wickets in hand. Rashid Khan comes on to bowl, goes 6 wickets, 6. Then Pakistan lose 3 wickets for 9 runs. And then Asif Ali, who's the sort of five-baller game specialist at number 7, kind of hits sixes at will or fails, but is like aced lots of chases basically coming in the last two overs in the past year or so. He hits 16 off 8, but then is out. Then comes this incredible moment. I don't know if you've seen this, but Farid Ahmed, the Afghan quickie, he's really good. He gives him a send-off. Then Asif Ali responds, sort of turns around, shoves him, winds his bat up over his shoulder as if he's about to sort of like clock him around the head. They have to be sort of like pulled apart and separated. He's marched off the pitch. They both only got, I think, a 25% match fee fine, which seems extraordinarily lenient. But I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing you do really, really like to see. So, that leaves them with 1 wicket in hand, 12 runs needed to win off 7 balls. Nazim Shah, 19 years old. This is his first T20 competition of any, or T20i competition of any kind, and played before this tournament. He comes in, knocks single down to long off his first ball. Next over, Fazal Haq Farooqi, had been one of the bowlers of the tournament up to that point. He, to be fair, bowls 2 of his poorer balls, 2 full tosses. But this is a 19-year-old who had hit 3 T26s in his career before that moment. Hits 2 consecutive sixes over straight down the ground. It goes absolutely mad, sort of sprinting, like tearing off his gloves, his helmet, pure veins throbbing, full-scale, full-team pitch invasion. It was just an absolutely incredible moment. I mean, it was probably spine-tingling, and it's worth just... I mean, I really like franchise cricket. I think it can be very high quality, very entertaining, but you don't get that sort of passion and that sort of moment. So that was incredible. Then you had the dead rubbers, which weren't really dead. I mean, you had the Kohli 100, it's been an interesting one with him, it's a big moment obviously for him to get that off so many times. And you could if you wanted to draw parallels with Sachin's 100th international 100, which also came in the Asia Cup, came against Bangladesh, and in some ways, you know, the build-up to that had been like almost like he'd been detrimental to India's side as they sort of kept him in to so he could get to that, and then that 100 was actually one that almost lost them the game, and they didn't make the final of that competition, and you could see this as like, is it a good thing for India that he's got this, has now bought himself a bit more time on the side. But this was a really, really brilliant innings, and he was really good all through the tournament. And he really showed that he can get with this new way that India are trying to play of being much more attacking. And he was brilliant against the spinners in particular. He was scoring really, really quickly against Gem. I think to get to his 100 and go just past it, he's got 60 off 19 balls. He accelerated incredibly. It really did look like the Kohli of old. This wasn't a guy sort of getting a 100 against a cow team. I know they were knocked out, but this was, I think there really were signs that Kohli might well be back to something approaching.
What was his reaction like? I haven't seen it.
It was relief, but it wasn't like the full pumped up sort of Edgbaston two arm spread Roy. There was a big smile on his face. I mean, he got there with a 4 and a 6. He would have been fully entitled to, you know, to say, yeah, whoever talk now, sort of thing. But it was more joy, and it was very sweet afterwards, sort of thanking his wife so much for supporting him through all the time. And I mean, they do get a pretty tough time. I mean, I don't know, you see videos of sort of paparazzi just following them around on a moped, basically, as they're trying to go about their daily lives. It must be a really sort of suffocating environment to be in at times. It was just quite nice, I think, more than anything else. And then we come to the final, which is also a really good game. To start with, you think the story is going to be the Pakistan quicks. I mean, Nazim, who bowled brilliant in the tournament as well, starts off with his third ball is this hooping in-swinger at 142 kph to bowl Kasur Mendis, and it's not even the best ball of the first half of the innings. Harris Ralph bowls this sort of 94 mile per hour, like a breakback, like it pitches sort of on off stump and then cuts back in to take out off a middle, like completely unplayable. Sri Lanka, they're 58 for 5, going just over a run of ball, and then Banuka Rajapaksa comes in and plays a real gem, is what, 70 off 45, I think. Pakistan went a bit cautious with the ball. They bowled Iftikhar Ahmed when they perhaps could have gone a bit more for the kill, but, you know, all credit to Sri Lanka for going for it, and they go up to 170. And then in the chase, Rizwan, you have to kind of say, played a bit of a... It was a shocker of an innings, really. I mean, Pakistan say they want to take it deep, which is a way of playing, for sure. But they were two down with 7 overs left, and at that point they need 12 and over. Rizwan gets out when they're... So he's the fifth wicket to fall. He gets out for 59 or 49, and the rate's up at 15. You've got something wrong there, basically. There was I can't remember who the Pakistan player was interviewed, but Rajapaksa was interviewed after the game saying that, when we were five down, we knew that we couldn't take a backward step. We had to keep coming at them, sort of thing. If we take a backward step, we were defeated. Whereas the Pakistan player was like, no, we want to take the game deep. We want to try and take it down to the wire and then hope our nerve holds. Those are both two ways of playing, but on this day, it was Sri Lanka who came out well on top. And of course, it's the Silverwood revolution carrying on, and it's hard not to feel happy for him after what was a real torrid 12 months from England.
No, it's great for him, and it probably puts into perspective just how impossible the job was to try and run and select that squad, that team, when he was in charge of England during obviously the COVID year and so on and so on. His kind of understanding of long-form cricket and his instincts with long-form cricket, which didn't maybe work with this collection of England players to play attritional sit-in kind of cricket, probably does work with more expressive players, perhaps counterintuitively. But if you're handed natural talents, but raw, maybe slightly jagged-edged kind of cricketers, but clearly there are very talented young players coming through in Sri Lankan cricket, and you bring that kind of pragmatism to it, then that's probably quite a potent combination. And you've seen it. You've seen it in the test game, and now you're seeing it as well. I mean, nobody would have fancied Sri Lanka to have won that tournament, really. And they've done it, as Ben brilliantly describes it. They've done that in real drama, you know, dramatic fashion. And while it wouldn't have necessarily been Silverwood's masterminding of it, it's really good for the bloke that he's found a new place to do his work, and it's working out so well for him. The game itself needs it as well. You know, as we know, there aren't too many teams that play at a top level, and Sri Lanka have been a kind of silent player for the last few years, really. They've had to shift, of course, from the loss of all those great players. But now there's a coherence and a cohesiveness to it, which is really good, I think, for the world game. And also, as I say, Test cricket is very much central to their mindset now as well, you know. Yeah. So it's good, and it's needed, because we need more variety and versatility in the game.
And he gets to leave a sense of kind of a white ball imprint on the Sri Lanka side. The thing was, when he was coaching England, is that he came in and the white ball side was settled, and you never really got a sense of, can Chris Hillwood actually kind of have, does he need to make an impact, basically, or is it the case that he just needs to like keep going with the flow of what's been happening for the last 4 or 5 years, essentially? Whereas now you can properly look at that Sri Lanka side and say, obviously there's, you know, there are touches of Silverwood here, essentially.
Whereas, and also, if England did well under Silverwood in white ball cricket, he just wouldn't get any credit.
Exactly, right? That's what
Morgan
saying,
is doing it. Yeah. And actually, with England struggling a bit in white ball cricket this summer, actually that reflects quite well on Silverwood, that things weren't as rosy behind the scenes as we thought. In Australia, Aaron Finch announced his immediate retirement from ODI cricket. He said,
you listened to the show last week.
He said, it is time now to give a new leader the best possible opportunity to prepare for and win the next World Cup. Finch is remaining the T20 captain. He's had a really, really bad run in ODI cricket in recent times, averaging less than 13 from 14 ODIs in 2022. He finished his ODI career with only Ponting, Mark Warren, David Warner having scored more ODI hundreds for Australia. Travis Head did really well for Australia opening the batting in Pakistan earlier in the year, so I reckon he's the guy who's going to come in. Australia beat New Zealand 3-0 in an ODI series this week. Cam Green and Sean Abbott had very good series for the Aussies. Cam Green's international numbers across formats are very, very good with bat and ball. Back in England, England beat India in the opening T20I of their series in Durham. Comprehensive victory. They won by 9 wickets with 7 overs to spare. Sarah Glenn picked up career best figures of 4 for 23. Sophia Dunkley scored a 50 at the top of the order, and Anis Capsey hit a quick unbeaten 30-odd to seal the game. Harmanpreet Kaur, the India captain, wasn't hugely happy with conditions at the end of the game. Said, I know it was not 100% right conditions to play cricket. I know the ground was too wet. There were so many chances to get injured, and one of our players also got injured. She was our main bowler, and that's why we were lacking. She's referring to left-arm spinner Radha Yadav. Amy Jones captained England for the first time after stand-in captain Nat Siver announced that she's going to be taking a short break from the game to focus on her mental health and well-being. Siver said, I've played a lot of cricket over the last 9 months, and I'm very emotionally fatigued. Elite sport demands a lot, and for the moment, I'm not able to perform without compromising my own well-being. So I need to take some time away from cricket in order to focus on myself. It's the right decision for me, and it's the right decision for the team.
That doesn't surprise me that Nat's come out and said that. I met up with her a couple of months ago for an interview, and she's always engaging. But you could see, this was just before the Commonwealth Games, and after, or in the midst of that South Africa series where it was a bit of a mismatch. And you could see that the strain, the relentlessness of it. It was quite telling that we did an interview in this vast aircraft hangar of a hotel lobby by Stansted Airport, and it felt plastic and fake and soulless. And I think she was wrestling with the remorselessness of touring life. And she spoke really well and quite affectingly about the human challenges, really, and especially being a 30-year-old woman, newly married. She wants to have children. She wants to take her life down that road. And how do you combine that with being an international cricketer? And there are life decisions that her and Catherine are facing and confronting in a way that the male equivalent 30-year-old cricketers wouldn't have to face. And silly as it sounds, it hadn't really occurred to me that they are the life decisions that you have to confront and ask yourself as a female cricketer. You kind of just take it for granted. You know, you're living some kind of dream, so you crack on. But of course, things are more complicated. So I wish her well. She's obviously a great cricketer, but an excellent person as well. Hopefully, she'll be back refreshed and ready to go again.
I saw a good stat about that T20. I think it might have been Hypercourse on Twitter who put it out. This was the first T20I that England have ever played that didn't involve at least one member of their 2017 World Cup final winning 11.
That's crazy.
Nice. Nice.
We're recording this on a Monday. A new round of the County Championship has started. Last week, though, Hampshire beat Northants by an innings in Division 1 to overtake Surrey at the top of the table, albeit having played a game more than their Championship rivals. Sam Cook took 7 for 33 in Essex's win over Kent, and Keaton Jennings continued his brilliant summer, scoring 150 in the drawn Roses game. In Division 2, Notts comfortably beat Leicestershire to extend their lead at the top, and it's very tight between Glamorgan, Derbyshire and Middlesex for the second promotion spot. I talked earlier about the interview on Sky with David Court and Mo Bobat. The bit that I found most interesting was how they assess possible England seamers. They basically said that there are four main factors that they assess: pace, release point, accuracy and movement, and they think you need to have two or three of those at least to have a chance. There are lots of interesting snippets of information in there. Stuart Board only has a release point of 2 centimetres more than James Anderson, which I was very surprised by. They also factor in your the team's win percentage when you play games. So, for example, Sam Curran doesn't actually factor that well on individual metrics, but England win a lot more games than when he plays than when he doesn't. And going back to Sam Cook, he was the other guy in the list of seamers they included. All the other guys are people who've played for England in the last few months. And all the best seamers on that list average about 16 in the county championship in the last few years, which is what Cook averages. His career average is less than 20. And even though he's the slowest of the bowlers they mentioned, he is got the second best new ball average after Anderson, for example. Anderson's numbers were absurd, by the way. He averages 11 with the new ball in the county championship, and his average speed is faster than Broad, Potts, Robinson, Curran, Craig Overton, and Cook himself. So, yeah, I mean, the way they almost had it was like Sam Cook he's going to be the guy that comes into the squad when Anderson eventually calls it a day.
Cook's week, by the way, you say that he took 7 for, he took 10 in the match, and just 2 days before the start of the match, he takes 4 for in the 100 final. Mm. Pretty handy.
The most underrated cricketer in the world. Mm. Anderson, of all the stats, all the Anderson stats, the fact that he's still the quickest bowler in this whole setup, that must be the one that he cherishes the most in the here and now. That is extraordinary, isn't it? Mm. All of these young bucks coming through, and he's got 15, 16 years on him, and he's still wanging it down there quicker than the rest.
And how Stuart Broad's release point only 2 centimetres more than Anderson.
Yeah, they'll collapse front leg and the wide arm, isn't it?
Two things that I picked out. One was that Sam Cook's old ball numbers were also absurd. I mean, he's averaging...
He just doesn't bowl bad balls.
He's averaging 17.5.
He doesn't bowl bad balls.
137 times. But also, Robinson actually almost improves with the slightly older ball. So he, according to this, so won't be correct to this test match, I think, but averaged 27.5 in tests from overs 1 to 29 and 25 from that point onwards. And that's replicated in first-class cricket as well, which I think is interesting, especially when you're going into Pakistan. But also interesting, considering England have given him the new ball. I guess they do still see him as the bigger threat there, even though he has that other string to his bow. He is a very good bowler.
Whenever he bowls. Phil, there's a new magazine coming out this week. Before we run through different interviews, etc., that's in it, let's talk about the main feature, I guess, which is where you ask 11 people from around the game to explore the question, what does cricket mean to them now and in the future? We've got names ranging from Michael Holding to Tatar. what was the thinking behind...
Was that the top and the bottom? Mm-hmm.
Age-wise.
Right, okay.
What was the thinking behind doing the feature? I can't remember anything quite like it, at least in the last couple of years.
So it's called Articles of Faith. Good headline, that's one of mine. And it stemmed from a conversation that Joe and me had, an idle conversation about our relationship with the game on a personal, not a spiritual level, but on a sort of existential level, right? And it occurred to us that we'd both been asking ourselves that question separately. And it comes in the context of a game that is changing before our eyes and evolving at breakneck speed. And so it stood to reason, we thought, that if the game is changing its look and complexion, almost it bears very little resemblance to the game that we used to know or that we grew up with. And the priorities are shifting and the old hierarchies are changing. So therefore, it stands to reason that our own relationship with the thing will evolve as well. And then, of course, there is within this question, there is one's point in life, right? You know, and how priorities shift and change. And it's a lot easier to be wild about a game of cricket at 20 than it is at 40. Trust me on that one. So anyway, we started this chat idly, and then we branched it out and started speaking to other people. And it turned out that lots of people were having this internal monologue with themselves, if you like. And so this article grew from there. It felt a bit counterintuitive on a certain level to run a magazine where, you know, it requires people to put a few quid on the table in order to receive it. And it kind of confers a positivity, a sort of celebratory nature, right? A magazine tends to do that. But it felt like this was the right time to ask this question. And whatever answers we were going to get, we were going to run with a range of people. So as you say, from Holding to Ishigua to Taha to David Lloyd to John Stern to Glenn Turner, the great New Zealand opening bat, to Joe himself. I write the intro. Vish, who everybody knows, he's written a piece as well. Mel Farrell's written a piece. Claire Connor wanted to, and I'm going to interview her next week on the same subject. We couldn't quite get it done for this issue, but it was a question that seemed to strike a chord with people. Now, I don't want to present this as a kind of universally bleak outcome, because it's not that. There are many kernels of positivity and optimism within people's answers. There are some who say, and I have it in front of me here, Michael Holding says he hardly watches cricket these days. He finds it too painful. He has very little respect for short-form white ball cricket. And watching the West Indies, you know, flounder along, he finds that too painful. He's reached a point in his life where he has a standoffish relationship with it. Isha, for example, credits cricket with pulling her out of any sadness, any personal difficulties. Cricket's always, she describes cricket as a great kind of sense of sukha, if you like, you know, and talking about cricket remains a joy for her and will do, she hopes, forevermore. Matt Roller, whose name I didn't mention earlier, but he's the young, you know, he's on the show last week. He's a brilliant young writer, and he comes at it from the new generation's perspective, and he says, I mean, he talks about the IPL and short-form cricket, and he says of the hundreds of millions who tune into the IPL final every year, unenlightened people. And so he makes the point that while the game is changing complexion, you can also make a very strong, valid case that the game is more democratic, more open, more colourful than it's ever been before. So this is not an exercise in pity or in middle-aged angst. It throws up various different positions, and it comes from a place of love, I suppose. So that's why we wanted to do it.
Reading it, it was almost like.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I did, but it was almost like couple counselling in written form.
Kind yeah, of
like,
right. Yeah.
This is how things are changing. Let's just say how it is, and then let's talk about it honestly.
It's not a question that we ask very much, though, is it?
No.
We're constantly dealing with the issues, and if it's on a good day, we might come up with some sort of half-baked solution for an issue. But normally we're just talking about the things, the problems. This was about one's personal relationship with it, how it waxes and wanes, how you keep the ambivalence at the door, how you maintain a degree of love and devotion to this ludicrous thing, even when there are times when you doubt it.
I think for those who've written, I've read it, and for those who are kind of, I guess, struggling a bit, part of writing it is about how do we make peace with how the game moves forward, where do we look to in the game to kind of find our place as it continuously changes.
I think not to get too bleak, but with I think there's a study released last week that five of the major signposts for our battle with climate change have already gone past the tipping point. I basically think that's already happened in Test cricket, and we don't talk about that enough. So I was watching every now and again. I go on YouTube and watch some highlights from the 90s or whatever. And I was watching it wasn't in my week off, but before that, I was rewatching the Lara 153. And then when he hits the winning runs, you got Pat Kensington Oval, crowd go wild, completely packed with locals. Test cricket isn't that anymore. West Indies play in front of no one. And I know that other forms of the game have taken its place in terms of spectator viewing in the stadium. I think it's totally fine if someone has watched cricket all their lives isn't okay with that because the thing they fell in love with no longer exists in the same way. I think that's fine. And I think a lot of people view Holding's position on T20 cricket as a bit unreasonable. But if that's what he fell in love with when he was a kid in the 60s, I think that's fine for him not to, to appreciate T20 cricket and understand the value that other people have in it. But from a personal point of view, to be like, yeah, not for me. And I think that that's fair enough. I quite like that.
For the punters who read it, I'd really like to have this conversation with them as well. And so if you do get a hold of the, of this, please do ask yourself that question. If you feel compelled to write into us or to tweet us or whatever, then I've actually asked for that on the article itself. You know, please do engage with this yourself, because it's a question that is clearly... It's a, like a bellwether question, I suppose. And it seems to have tapped into to people more than many of the other things that we do. Let's put it that way. So yeah, if you're out there and you do read it and you are affected by it, you know, or touched by it, then please do write in, because I'd love to hear from you.
What else is in the magazine?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Did about a week ago. Cool. Loads of good stuff.
Cool.
But that thing.
Well, as always, if you want to buy the magazine, head to wisdom.com/shop. That is it for today's show. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Phil. And thank you to our heart. This has been the Wisdom Cricket Weekly Podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.
Sports Social Podcast Network.